Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is now 9:00 on August 8th, 2023. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. With us today, we have Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Colin Willenbrock, General Counsel, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Judy Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager to discuss, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. Now I'll turn it over to Mr. Harlow. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. We'll get right after things with our media update and Aaron Swainy. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Swainy, PR Media Liaison for PUD. Good to be here this morning to talk about some of the stuff we've been talking about on the media and just some of the communications we've been putting out. Okay, first up, we had some really good coverage on our crews going to Guam. So great story. You know, we were one of the only utilities that stepped up to go out and help Guam. And we were over there for quite a while. Guys were working over there for 16-hour days, putting in a ton of work. When they came back, the Everett Herald did a nice story. Kelly worked with them on that. And then throughout, before we left, during the time we were there, and even after we returned, Paul Ciampoli from APPA did a bunch of stories on Public Power Daily for us and really did a good job of just kind of keeping up, telling the story of all the crews over there and what they were doing. So good coverage there.
I have one observation, not a question.
Sure.
But I have seen from the work that was done in Guam, absolutely outstanding photos. And I hope that they will, were they taken by our crew?
Some of them were. I think we got a lot from like Paul Kiss. Paul would text us at like 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning, or, you know, he was getting texts from all times of the night because obviously.
Well, they were phenomenal, some of them.
Yeah, some of the photos are amazing.
The one that was in this report. But yeah. I hope that we don't lose sight of the fact that we submit them.
Yeah.
In terms of recognition.
Yeah, and we had people go down and take these photos, but when they were, you know, loading the trucks up and getting ready to go. So we had some of the photos are our folks. Krista took some of the photos when they returned. We kept all of them. So we collected all of them and make sure we have them.
They did a good job.
Yeah.
I mean, they.
They did do a good job, right?
I mean, this one is.
Yeah, this is, I love this photo. Yeah, the Guam, was it the Power Authority? Is that?
Yeah, GPA.
They did a lot on social media. They called us out constantly.
Yeah.
They did.
They were super appreciative.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to hold up your report.
No.
I just had to get that out.
No, that's great. Appreciate it.
I was blown away by 15-hour days. No breaks.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I think they were pretty tired when they got back.
Yeah.
They did a lot of work over there. So it was great to be able to shine a little light on all that. And like you said, get all that amazing photo.
Thank you for all the coverage.
Next up, we had our crews that actually were involved in a life-saving incident where they saw some smoke coming out of a garage in Briar, knocked on the door, got the family out, you know, made sure that everybody was safe. Linwood Times did a story, MLT News did a story on this. They were honored by the Briar Fire Department. So very cool. And I think they've also got the governor's life-saving award as well coming up. So very cool. I really think it goes to show the safety culture that we have here. You know, it just imbues everything that we do and makes it so they jump into action wherever they see that kind of stuff. So easy story for us to tell, and it's that safety message out there. We also have the new heat event rules, and actually it sounds like it's going to be hot this weekend, so some of this stuff might actually be coming into, you know, reality very soon for us. But we put out a press release talking about that. It was picked up by a number of local, you know, blogs and media, just talking about making people aware that we won't be shutting off during high heat events. And then just a couple other things. Our Everett Herald column last month was decoding your new bill, so just kind of walking through customers, letting them know what that new bill says and kind of explaining why we redesigned it to kind of help them out and get that information out there. And then our August column will be on a focus on community events, all that we're doing this fall and August at the fair. And then Seattle Times has a story on rate increases and how electricity rates are going up and up. I'd like to say that ours was the lowest of the group. They kind of put ours way at the bottom. Yeah, so I think that was nice that it looked, you know, pretty good in comparison to some of our competitors. And then a media event we have coming up on August 17th. We're inviting the media out to the Arlington Microgrid. We have a bunch of line workers out there working on the high voltage ARC trailer, also doing a pole top rescue. And it's a great opportunity to bring the media out, talk to them about safety during, you know, storms, give them some idea of, you know, when you're contacting us, you know, please talk to the media folks. Don't just approach our crews, which happens sometimes during storms. And then I'd like to say, Kelly did a great job on this story in the bulletin for July. Just a great story. It's the cover story. It's all about all the great work we've been doing in the communities. Got tons of just amazing photos in there. So it's a great opportunity to brag on all the work that not only you know, our group's doing and the community events groups like Laura and David are doing, but just overall wide as a utility, all the people that are pitching in and doing a great job to help us be out in the community and talk to our customers. And then another thing that we just hosted that Alex Corey helped us with and Jessica Spar, we hosted the PIOs, which are the public information officers. So basically my position at school districts and cities and other utilities around the region. We hosted them at the microgrid, gave them a tour, gave them a bunch of information on just what, you know, battery storage is, why it's important for the future of the utility. And it's great because it gives people who are out there talking about stuff, it gives them that kind of context and nuance about what we're doing. So a good opportunity for that. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Safety Days is tomorrow and Thursday. And Kelsey Wiebe did an amazing job with highlights. So this will be out there. You can pick these up, but it's like 12 pages of just great content about Safety Days and all the amazing demos and classes and everything going on out there. So check it out.
Can we get that in our online?
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
No, I'm not asking you to do it. I say, is it there?
It's not in there because it just came out
okay.
On Friday. So it's a little bit
I'm late. Not asking you to do it.
I can have some hand delivered to you guys if you'd like.
I just want to make a comment that I think it's wonderful that we're pushing out our employees on social media or into the wire. I think that's really great for people to make those connections that it's an organization.
Yeah.
They own this, their neighbors are working at.
Yeah. Yeah, we redesigned the wire at the beginning of the year, and one of the things we did was to highlight employees in each one. And we're really using the employee of the month to kind of springboard into that. But we have such amazing employees here that work here. It's not, you could throw a rock and find somebody that's amazing to highlight. So why not, right? Why not talk about it?
Throw a rock and safety.
Yeah, that wouldn't be safety
games. Bad
please.
Probably bottling question.
They're false.
Yeah, there's no truth.
Thank you.
Excellent job, Aaron. Aaron obviously gave the highlights, but it is pretty impressive the amount of work that is going on and the amount of exposure that we have. Community fairs, Lake Steve was Aqua Festival was going on last weekend. Great representation there, water department, electric. There's so many cool things going on, and it's fun to see us connecting in great ways with our community. That, to me, that is what public power is all about, and we do a fantastic job of it. Our folks do a fantastic job of it. Okay, next up is Jeff Feinberg with our low income weatherization agreement with Snohomish County. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. And so for starters, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Jennifer Keene. She's an energy assistance program manager that we brought on last November. And as of August 1st, she left us to join our peer stakeholders at Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. It's a really great opportunity for her. But the reason I'm sharing that is she's been working on this agreement with the county for the last several months, and this is her presentation that I get the opportunity to get to present. And so, if Jennifer, if you're listening, congratulations on your opportunity, and we will miss you. And so with that, let's just jump in here. And so the purpose of this presentation today is we're going to talk a little bit about the program and just kind of give you guys an update, because it's been a couple of a little bit over a year since we've been back to talk about this and to talk about the new agreement that we're working on with the county, which we'll come back in a couple of weeks and ask for approval of. So what is the Income Qualified Weatherization Program? So it's a long-running program that provides free home energy upgrades for any of the customers that qualify. It is a part of a federal block grant. So all the funds come from the federal government, they're sent to Washington State, and then those are dispersed to the community action agencies around the state. And here in Snohomish County is our weatherization agency. And so we partner with them. And the services that are included is things like insulation, air and duct sealing, weather stripping, heating system repairs, a little bit of everything. And one of the things that we're really excited about is the federal government recently changed some of the rules, and so there's more funds available for actual home repairs. So in the past, sometimes a customer might actually qualify and they may go out and get a home assessment. But if they had something like, say, a hole in their roof, until the customer was able to repair the hole in their roof, they wouldn't be able to receive the weatherization benefits. But thanks to some changes at the federal level, we are now able to see some of those home repairs as a part of the actual weatherization that happens in the home. And so that's no longer an obstacle for customers. And so that's part of what you'll see the increase is going towards that we'll speak about here in just a moment. The big piece here is Snohomish County is the administrator of the program, and we are just a partner agency. And then everything that happens in this program, we also pursue BPA reimbursement for as well as part of our EEI funding. So who does this program serve? So over 16% of all of our customers meet the income requirements to participate in this program, which is 200% of the federal poverty level or below. Furthermore, of those customers, about 15% of them have an energy burden greater than 6%, which you'll recall from the Clean Energy Transformation Act, though it's primarily about decarbonization, there's also a huge component around energy assistance. And the customers that we are tasked with serving and making progress at helping reduce energy burden are those at the 200% federal poverty level or below, and with a burden above 6%. So every customer that's served through this program is also a part, is a direct customer that we should be assisting with Clean Energy Transformation Act assistance. And we have the robust goal of by 2030, we're supposed to be targeting reaching 60% of those customers, or at least understanding the funding levels required. So this is a really key program in that piece as well. And so since reopening in 2020, they've already served about 300 households, over 420,000 of KWH savings. But the real benefit, and this is kind of the piece that we really wanted to share, is it's the people, right? And this program not only delivers KWH savings and it helps us with energy assistance and all those kinds of things, but really at the end of the day, with any of our programs and energy services, we always try to think about the customer being in the room with us, whether it's a commercial and industrial customer or a residential homeowner. And these are just a few customer testimionals, and I'll give you a moment to read those. I'm sure you probably already have. But the reality is this helps customers be safe in their homes. This helps customers be more comfortable in their homes. And really, it reduces that burden to participate in energy efficiency programs where they otherwise likely would not if it weren't for a program like this. Because as you guys know, the upfront cost is oftentimes one of the greatest barriers for customers making these kinds of improvements.
Jeff, how does this program match up the qualifications to our rate assistance program?
They are actually exactly even.
Wow.
So, and that was part of back in July of 2020 when we asked to move up to 200% of federal poverty. Part of that was to have that one-for-one connection.
So anytime one of our employees on the phone with somebody, and if they qualify for that program, they can be referred.
Definitely.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the cross-referral that definitely happens. And then vice versa. One of the things we're really excited about, and we'll be back to talk to you guys about here shortly, is we're in the process right now of establishing several more streamlined and auto-enrollment relationships with agencies around the county, where if a customer does receive benefits through that agency, then they can actually just send us the customer information and be approved for our rate discount. And so that's something else that Jen was working on before she left, but can't wait to list off the names of the different agencies that we are establishing these relationships with. But that's coming, and we're really excited about that.
So the nearly 300 households, is it limited about, is it, the program just has a certain amount of money? Is that all that will sign up for it, or?
So
probably just not more.
Yeah, so it's a combination of a couple things. At this point, it's a little bit limited by the amount of contractors that the county's program has that can actually do these upgrades. Because some of these upgrades are quite substantial and, you know, they might be doing everything on the home. And so that's one of the big reasons is administratively, the county's kind of at max capacity for what they can do. We will say that we've really seen the county do more and more over the last couple of years, and we continue to kind of work with them on an ongoing basis to say, you know, what would it take to serve more households, and, you know, is it a dollar issue? Is there some way we can kind of help with administration? And so we have that ongoing conversation to think about how we might be able to reach more. Yeah. And so the proposed amendment, back in 2019, it's when we entered into this type of relationship with counties. We've had a partnership with the county in this program for a really long time. Up to 2019, though, it was through the Matchmaker program where we would send our funds to the state and then the state would bring them back to the county. When we changed in 2019, the real benefit here is we have this direct relationship with Snohomish County. And so that allows us to have a lot more flexibility over the measures that are included in the program. And it just lets us have a real good dialogue with them kind of in real time. And a really good example of this, I mean, just last week, we had a customer home where they had an oil furnace. The oil furnace had died a couple of years ago, and for several heating seasons, the customer had been heating their home with space heaters. And so what we had to validate is first we needed to know that it was an electrically heated home, right? And so we were able to quickly work with the county and define that it was an electrically heated home, even though it had this broken down oil furnace. And then we were able to kind of authorize and move forward with serving that customer and decommission the oil furnace according to BPA rules and all of that. But the big piece there is there wasn't this kind of administrative challenge of they go to the state, they come to us, but instead we just had a quick email, quick conversation, we authorized it, and they were able to go ahead and serve the customer. And so it's things like that, plus also just updating the measure list that we've really gained in the flexibility of working directly with the county. And so we came in 2020 and in 21 and we amended this. The amendment that we're proposing and asking for your approval in 2 weeks would extend up to the end of 2025, and you'll see there's a pretty large funding increase, but again, the primary reason for that is there's certainly been inflation, but we're also adding some measures that are a little bit more expensive, and there is this increased ability to do home repair. And I'll just highlight the smart T stats as one of the things that we've added. And one of the things we're doing across all of our energy services, energy efficiency programs, is we're trying to, where we can, put the capability in already for grid harmonization and demand response when the time comes, so that customers that are participating with any of these upgrades can just jump right in and participate with demand response once that's available. So none of our programs are gonna just be EE programs for much longer. But we're really excited about that.
That's good work.
Thank you. Yeah, so with that, we'll be back on August 22nd, but I'm open to questions.
So the people who had the electric heat, the space heaters, were they able to get a heat pump or something?
They'll get the HVA system that makes the most sense for their home. Yes. Yeah, we're excited about that.
Yes, I'm sure they are too. They love it.
Yeah. Not to mention it'll be a lot safer, right, than a bunch of space heaters in the home. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, great job, Jeff. Next up is Alex Chori with an update on our two Layla microgrid projects. Morning, Alex.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good
morning, John.
Welcome.
How do we get the button? There we go. All right.
Hi.
So I'm Alex Corey. I'm in our Energy Storage and Emerging Technologies group, and I just wanted to give you guys an update on some of the work that we're doing with Tulalip. I was here about a year ago to talk about some initial feasibility studies for working with them to build microgrids at two sites for them. We're still working on those, but there's been some larger visioning and discussions about where those could go in the future. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about that partnership and what those projects might look like. All that being said, we're not necessarily looking for any decisions or anything here today. I just kind of want to let you guys know what we're looking at. However, as we move forward with this, if we do decide to work with them, there's going to be some pretty significant internal discussions here at the PUD about what policy changes need to happen, what kind of legal and operational agreements need to be put in place to really kind of have a co-ownership of some assets. And I'll get into some of the details in just a little bit here. But basically, there's the potential that if Tulalip builds their system in a way that, you know, is with some PUD guidance, it could really benefit them quite a bit more, add some more value to what they're building, but also really benefit us as well in terms of a capacity resource and just a lot of lessons learned about integrating these sorts of microgrid systems. So right now, our current study, Clean Energy 4, the Commerce Department, we are looking at two sites for Tulalip to build behind the meter microgrids, which likely would look pretty similar to what we have up at Arlington right now, solar, battery, tying in with existing diesel generators. Those studies are scheduled to be completed pretty soon. We're working through them. Even though CEF4 is not yet wrapped up, the Commerce Department has already put out CEF5. Tulalip is pretty excited about the potential here, so they have already applied as the lead applicant for CEF5 funding to build a behind the meter microgrid at their gathering hall site. Our work as part of that will be a partner with them. We'd be listed as the utility partner. There's not a ton for us to do, but just kind of provide support direction to them as they build their system. But if there is the potential to move forward with a more expansive system in the future, kind of help guide their installation in such a way that it facilitates moving on to future phases of this project. So the initial phase, which is what they're applying for right now and what we're kind of wrapping up the study on, is the behind the meter microgrid at the gathering hall, which is their community center. It serves, it's got kitchen, locker rooms, it can serve as a heating and cooling center. It's kind of just a community building right now. But if they were to throw solar panels on the roof or in the parking lot, add a battery to their existing backup generator, develop the control system for that, as well as building load management, they could have a community support building that's able to operate during an extended outage, still provide those essential services to the community. That would all be on their side of the meter, and that's great. We support that, but there's not necessarily a ton for us to do. And as we get into phase two and phase three and potential expansion, our involvement will become a little bit more, in depth. But right now, even if Tulalip doesn't get awarded CEF5 funds, I think it's pretty likely that they will move forward with at least the first phase of this project. There are a ton of funding opportunities for tribes right now for clean energy projects and community resiliency. I've got a little more information on that, but now is a good time to be looking at building these sorts of projects.
So is there opportunity in phase one for them to do some kind of demand response program for us?
There would be, and yes, so that I mean, yeah, the lessons that we've learned and the agreements we might put in place would be really helpful. And that would, I think, set us up very well for future situations like this.
Yeah.
However, moving into phase two and a little more expansive system, there'd be a lot more lessons learned. But yes, totally, that's the direction we're heading. That's one of the benefits that we would get out of acting as a partner with them, help us figure out our system. So as we started the study, pretty much right off the bat of looking at the gathering hall, it became immediately apparent that building an isolated or an individual system at the gathering hall itself is great, especially if funding is there. It provides some resiliency for the tribe. However, the opportunity in the immediate area surrounding the gathering hall is really unique in that it's a fairly easily isolatable chunk of our grid. They've got a bunch of other critical facilities right next door, physically and electrically speaking. They've got the gathering hall right across the street. There's a medical building, an elementary school, a Boys and Girls Club, a wing of the Northwest Indian College, and space for a larger solar array. So if that little bubble of the microgrid that would sit initially just at the gathering hall could be expanded a little bit to encompass those other buildings, Tulalip's now got a pretty decent sized chunk of, I guess you could call it a resiliency zone or a microgrid zone that they could keep up and running during an extended outage. That would potentially mean taking ownership or co-ownership of some of our 12 kV system. The installation of a smart recloser or protective device, we could open a switch, island that little section during an outage, they could basically operate through their solar array, through their batteries, through their diesel generators. I know we don't love operating diesel generators, but they're already there. Let's take advantage of that equipment while it's there until we can really move into more, even more renewable and clean energy sources. So there's a lot of discussion that would go along with what co-ownership of this piece would mean. Tulalip would really gain some great resiliency and community support in a larger area. It would be a great case study for the PUD to start figuring out, like you said, how do we integrate these sorts of resources that are customer owned onto our system. I've got a messy picture here, but a little light. All right. So down in the corner is our existing microgrid, the gathering hall, which would be kind of the seed. As you move to the left, the medical facility is right there. The elementary school and the Boys and Girls Club to the north with space for solar. The blue lines here kind of represent our existing electric grid. So up at the top, a smart recloser installed in that spot could really isolate this whole chunk. All these buildings could be tied together. You've got a total of maybe 600 kilowatts of solar, megawatt or two of battery, the existing diesel generators. This area could really, frankly, one of the existing diesel generators could power this whole area as it stands right now. But we'd love to start integrating these new clean energy resources. The funding is there for Tulalip to start procuring these and building it out. So this is, they're a single owner. They own all the land. They're a single partner for us to deal with. We encompass multiple buildings. It would be a really cool opportunity for us to partner with them and help them build their system in a way that we could really, really work together and realize benefits for both PUD and the tribe.
And they're providing a lot of labor, right?
Yeah, I mean, it will remain to be seen, but generally speaking, yeah, their funding, they would probably be getting the solar panels, getting the batteries, managing all of the installation. If there's work on our system, we would probably step in, but generally speaking, mm-hmm. we'd just kind of be providing technical assistance to them for how they construct all of their stuff. It's kind of a win-win.
So help me understand what we're thinking about our system within this microgrid. Would we continue to operate it? Would we sell it to them? Because I'm thinking about the implications for when we have more of these down the road.
Yes. That's definitely the big question. So, you know, right now at each of these individual buildings, well, they have their own diesel generators tied to each one. And they could throw solar and battery on the roof as they stand and all kind of operate independently. That's easy and that's fine, especially if they have the funding for it. But if they really kind of all tied together using our 12 kV system, at least in this little chunk, provides a little bit more flexibility for them. But yes, what that operational agreement would look like, there's a lot of safety concerns and legal concerns. Yeah. And the initial plan is if they could build their behind the meter gathering hall, that would take a couple years. That would buy everybody the time to start navigating what these agreements would look like and then decide, does it make sense to expand to phase two? You know, is there value there for everyone?
Fascinating. It's a negative project.
It's a cool opportunity for sure. So if you thought that was cool, let's talk phase three. these dates are certainly a little aggressive, but as I mentioned, right now for Clean Energy Fund 4 studies, we're looking at the gathering hall and the administration building as separate sites for building a microgrid. The admin building's about a mile south of the gathering hall. We started a similar build at that location. As we move north, we could incorporate some additional solar arrays or additional batteries that Tulalip's eyeing installation of. These basically two microgrid bubbles could grow and then eventually merge into a much larger cohesive system. Now you're talking a couple hundred homes, you've got a fire station, their data center, a senior living facility, the cold food storage that Tulalip has at their marina. Now they've got a pretty good chunk of their system that can remain operational, but certainly increases the complexity. And even more messy drawing up in the north, or the top of this drawing, is the little area for the gathering hall microgrid. The admin building starts down in the south, but as we add those resources moving north, eventually merge all of this, It's a lot. It would be a pretty decent operational agreement. Now you're not just talking about a single little wing that's easy to isolate. Now they're really incorporated as kind of part of the grid. But the advantage for us is once you have all these resources here, now you're talking 6 to 10 megawatts of battery and 2 to 3 megawatts of solar. That's actually a capacity resource that you can really take advantage of. And as I think was presented recently in the IRP, batteries and energy storage are kind of starting to play more of a role in our portfolio. And we can keep building the large batteries like we're doing at Arlington. But if we can start figuring out how to take advantage of some customer-owned battery resources, could play a key piece in the landscape of the future. It's not, frankly, if it's not too late now, there's a good chance that it's going to be somebody else in 6 months or a year. Costco comes in and wants to put solar panels on the roof and a 1 megawatt battery right next to their backup generator, and they're going to come to us and say, is there any opportunity for us to partner here? The lessons learned here and the framework, the communications framework between our system operators and SCADA that we could put in place here would really make it much easier to integrate those future resources as they come down the line.
Yeah, that map is fascinating. I mean, that's really an ambitious project, but it's interesting because in the end we're talking about a community instead of both of those either. Because our site is, you know, essentially a lot. So this, and then I can see the complexity of working our own system, and there's a lot more trees in this expansion than there was in the previous. Kick out power lines and yeah, someone have to repair.
Sure. And I mean, so on that note, we put in funding for Snow Smart and basically all of the smart upgrades that would be used for fault isolation through DOE grants. You know, the equipment we'd be installing as part of that would dovetail very nicely with what we'd be putting in here, those isolation points, the ability to switch things around. You know, this, like you said, this is a big swing and it's probably a little quite a few years out, but just the planning and coordination as we go forward, knowing that these things may be coming kind of at the same time.
Do you know if tribal members or people and the people who live on the reservation are being educated about this or informed about this?
Yes.
Because it would be so good to have some enthusiasm among the people who actually, I mean, who might support it.
Agreed.
Probably would support it. I'm excited about it, and I don't even live there.
Well, and so, you know, we're utility people, and it's a little bit easier for us to understand, but it's still a lot.
I know.
That being said, for the tribe, who's not a utility at all, even their leadership, bringing them up to speed on what it means is a lot. That being said, I recently attended a clean energy summit, tribal clean energy summit hosted by Tulalip a month or two ago. Hmm. My understanding is pre-COVID, they maybe had 30 or 40 attendees. This one had a couple hundred, and it was Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, Washington and Oregon, and a bunch of tribal members from all across the West. And the message was very strong being put out there. The money is there for you guys to get into clean energy projects. Even discussion of shifting from gaming as a revenue source, there's a big opportunity here for them. And so at least among leadership on the tribal side, I think there's a lot of excitement about this. But frankly, they don't fully sure understand everything that's being thrown at them. There's a lot of money on the table. They hear about microgrids. They think it seems cool. But yeah, we've been working hard to update them.
I wasn't expecting that they would know every detail, but just the concept.
They're excited about it.
And the possibilities, that's what's...
Their chairwoman gave a presentation at the last Marysville Chamber meeting, and she mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a great opportunity for a partnership that really benefits both of us.
So great. That is happening. Will that?
And so, yeah, like I just talked about, there's a ton of money out there for tribes, I would say, between now. I mean, in the next year, there's probably $5 to $10 million on the table for Tulalip to go grab to fund these sorts of projects, and they're in a great spot to do so. Just they're forward thinking, they already have a utility partner that they're working with through our Clean Energy Fund 4 stuff. It's a really good opportunity for them. So we already talked quite a bit about the challenges here. Of course, what does it look like to hand over even a small piece of our system to someone else to operate during an emergency situation? There's safety concerns. What does it mean when damage occurs? What does it mean when the meters are turning when they're in islanded mode? We're not current currently really prepared to deal with that. But the discussions that we would have surrounding this sort of a project, I think, would really set us up well for future projects too. Anti-Lab's a great partner. They're excited about this. We already have so many other ongoing discussions with them, and we work really closely with them. I think we couldn't ask for a better partner in a project like this. And the lessons that we would learn from this for future distributed energy resource integration. Like I said, it's going to be a lot. There's going to be some painful lessons, I think, but it's really, it would really set us up well for future projects over the next couple, 5-10 years. And so for next steps, I mean, frankly, things are kind of moving forward already as we speak. Since we're already doing CEF4, Tulalip's planning on building the gathering hall. We've tried to phase the planning of this in such a way that there are small chunks that can be bitten off. And if it stops after the gathering hall microgrid is built, it's not like money was wasted. That's still a functional piece of the system for them. There's still the discussion about how do we deal with that as a capacity resource on the PUD side to kind of get some benefit to both of us. But if there is the appetite to expand a little bit further, trying to lay the groundwork for what that might look like, both internally and on the Tulalip side. So that's what I've got. Thanks for the time.
I do have a question or two.
Sure.
Michael doesn't ask. Mr. Olson has a question. Well, just one question. I should know this. And just some observations. I mean, this is very complex and you're really very early stages of it. I get that. Do we own the KV system on the reservation?
We do, yes. Yeah, so we own everything.
Okay.
Yeah, the easy breakdown is it's relatively easy for them to build on their side of the meter, whatever they want, but anything that integrates directly with our 12 kV system,
okay,
that's where the discussion is going to happen.
Okay, that's what's roomy. And also, I'm very supportive of a complex. Boy, do we like to tackle things. Very complex. But just observation, let's see, yes, for reimbursement. Will the PUD, in terms of the technical aspects, have opportunity for input and collaboration on, number one, the contractor's process and contractor selection? The selection will clearly be by the lead, but I'm hoping that utility will have the opportunity for input because it does affect their system.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think Tulalip recognizes that. And in fact, early discussions with them, I mean, they are totally on board with understanding that they're not a utility and they would lean heavily on us for exactly those kinds of decisions, that kind of support. Because I think they know, and probably we all know, if there's something that we're not totally comfortable with, it's not getting connected to our system.
Well, it's just, and also, don't even answer. I would assume that the tribes are not bound by RCW. Is that correct?
You want the technical answer? It depends.
Thank you. I don't want to go into it any further than that, but in terms of contractor selection. So just observation, and I certainly hope that we have that opportunity to. Why am I getting these smirks?
Great question, great comment.
They are good questions. They're very important questions.
Anyway, good presentation. I'm just always looking at logistics and protecting our system and ensuring, I guess I'm seeing that the PUD will be reimbursed for the work that is necessary to accommodate these, either through grant or academic.
So, I mean, I would expect that there will be, you know, some PUD expenses tied to this, but generally speaking, it's more just kind of the labor, or not the labor, not construction labor, but, you know, engineering support, technical assistance labor. But that being said, Tulalip has already applied for funding to that they will then funnel that money to us to install the sorts of protective equipment on our grid to support a project like this. Generally speaking, there will be some PUD expense, but in the grand scheme, it's
normal conditions, we are responsible for the work that's done on the grid.
Yes, typically, and again, yeah. I think the sharing agreement will be important.
Absolutely.
But we look at it as an investment. As Alex, described very well, this could provide huge benefit for us. Capacity, having those resources, access to those resources. So, yeah.
No, I just want to make sure we end up somewhat whole, take on our appropriate responsibility,
yep.
That protect our interests in our system.
And I think those sorts of discussions, it would be complex, but that would happen as part of that co-ownership agreement,
right.
When they're purchasing and procuring their large solar arrays or batteries, does the PUD pay for part of that, but then we get to use that as a capacity resources, or does Tulalip fully pay for it, but we give them some more advantageous rates to kind of balance out those costs? It's certainly a discussion that's above my head and will happen in the future, but your point is well taken, I think. We will have plenty of opportunities to make sure this is a balance.
Oh, no, this is very early, and I commend you folks for taking it on. I'm done, thank you.
So, state building codes would apply on the reservation to all that would be happening there.
I believe so.
Yeah. Oh, it's a magic.
Just go find some comments.
Oh, sure, go.
So, what a great opportunity! Fascinating. It has all the elements in it that I can imagine us needing in the future if the city wanted to island or something like that. So I guess the interesting part is I look at it. I comment on the trees because I'm thinking of a storm and trees down and power out, and essentially they would start backfeeding something that's prohibited into our system. To electrify the rest of their facilities, which may have outages within that system too. So really a lot to figure out, but I mean, you can just imagine that's where the future is gonna be.
Sure, and yeah, I mean, who knows would it look like they call SCADA or call ECC and say, hey, we've noticed an outage, are you okay with us disconnecting, or do you wanna send someone out to disconnect us? There'd still be potentially some PUD control over that, but yes, those would be some pretty significant.
Has a cut, it would be.
Fair enough. There would absolutely be PUD control.
Yeah, maybe.
The actual mechanisms to make that happen would be up for discussion.
There's an article in today's New York Times about a community in North Carolina of about 30 homes that were built, all part of a microgrid. Mm-hmm. Sort of fascinating, similar kind of thing, except it was they started with the end in mind. And to the benefit of their utility as well.
Sure. And we're building the large scale project at Arlington that's kind of like grid scale, and then you step it down to the neighborhood or this
right.
project or our Arlington microgrid scale, and then you've got the lower level of residential scale batteries and garages.
Yeah.
But this is a great sample project similar to that that's kind of right in that middle zone.
Yeah.
Good news.
I hope it all happens.
It's very hopeful.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you for all your work. On that. It's great.
Great job, Alex. Next up is our water policy updates. Wood. Good morning, Brent.
Morning, commissioners. Brent Wood, AGM of the Water Utility. Go over the water policy updates. You last heard this on December 20th. At that point, there's a couple developers and master builders that wanted a little bit more time to review and provide comments to our water policy update. So we met with them several more times, and I think they're in a good place right now. They're very comfortable with the changes that were.
Good to hear.
So the purpose of this is just a brief on the proposed policy updates. No action today. If you're okay with it, we'll bring it back for your final review of the actual marked up copy and approval at the August 22nd meeting. So just real quick, we'll give an overview of the existing water system, reasons for modifying the policy, communication of those policy changes, summary of the most significant policy changes, next steps, and then this question slide. Just really quick, we now have 9 water systems. We used to have 10. The Warren Beach and Kayak systems were integrated just recently, so now we have 9 systems.
Thank you for that kind of slide. So I've seen this so many times, but how is 212 Market served? Is that one building, the 212 Market?
212 Market is a really unusual system. It's a Group A TNC transient non-community system. It is just the gas station. We have a small well, and we treat the water, and we serve one customer.
So it's our well.
It's our well, and
we serve
the one customer.
Facility for one customer. And how about Otis? That looks like it's in the city of Arlington.
Otis is a small community system. It has 5 customers off of it. Again, a well serving 5 customers. When we originally took that on, the intent was that would transition over to City of Arlington when they ran their main from our master meter to the city. Fortunately, they took a little bit different route and didn't ask that little system. So we still own that small Group B system. So it's 5 customers serve on that small system. So those are the 2 very small systems we own and operate.
Fascinating.
Some general stats of note is last year we sold about 219 million cubic feet of retail and about 34 million cubic feet of wholesale. So this policy was last modified November 2013. Most of the changes, there's just a lot of housekeeping changes that we've done to clarify the existing policy and for consistency with the electric system customer service. Also, there's some changes to ensure the customers remain responsible for their monthly customer charge. It's the base charge. We're actually looking at transitioning the language. We've historically, for 20 years, had the term monthly customer charge. That's the fixed component charge of our rate. We'll try to get that more in line with the electric utility's new base charge. We're waiting for, I believe it's the AMI implementation to be done. There's a freeze right now to make those changes. So just every time I say monthly customer charge, we also tried to make those changes so that it could be a monthly customer charge, it could be a base charge, like a daily base charge. Right now, our monthly customer charge is a little bit tough to prorate since it's a monthly charge. We had a daily one, more like the electric utility is transitioned to, make it easier. And just keep the language consistent so that when they see their bill, they don't have on the water side, they have this a monthly customer charge that they've seen, you know, forever. But now on the electric side, they have the base charge. So it's trying to keep that language consistent, but we can't do it right now. Also looking to update the general facilities charge, and this is actually a typo that I just noticed this morning. It's not developer system charge, it's distribution system charge. Language to allow the AGM to waive the fees for customers transferring to a district water main. They're currently connected to a municipal transmission main within the district's water service area. So as an example, City of Everett has their transmission lines that run directly through our retail water service area. There are customers on that there's an opportunity that they can transition onto our main. We've in the past, historically, we've waived the GFC and the DSC. The DSC, as long as it's not going back to a third party. So the DSC is our latecomer mechanism for third party vendors who install mains. As long as it's not going back to them, we waive those fees to try to promote transfer from a transmission line to our system, that overlap of water service areas. So it's been doing it for years through policy section 1.4 of the policy, which allows the AGM to waive those fees if it makes sense and if the cost isn't significant. And if it is significant, you probably have seen over the years a memo that comes through within the next 2 board meetings explaining what we've done. There really haven't been that many, honestly. But this just kind of makes it really clear. It does promote that trying to transition those customers off those transmission mains, off City of Snohomish's main, save everyone's names onto our retail distribution system. Provide, so this next bullet is basically things that we heard from the master builders and some from developers. So language regarding stakeholder review, that was one of the big things that we've worked with them on. It's just when we change the policy, and we have done this in the past, but when we also change our standards, our construction standards, they really wanted more of an opportunity to comment, which I think is a great idea anyway. And we have got there, when there's been bigger changes in our standards that impacted the development community, we tried to get that feedback passed. But working with them, that was one of the biggest things that they wanted to see. They also wanted an appeals process related to the construction standards, system extensions, to allow that they Directive 80 allows them to appeal to the general manager and the board if it's a rates type related issue. They just wanted more clear in the policy itself. So we put some language in the policy, allowing them to dispute it to the general manager.
Within the general manager's authority.
Exactly. And then the next one is just updating our satellite management policy, section 4. That hasn't been changed since I think I've been here. We've done things a lot differently. We used to do all system acquisitions through LUDs. We hardly ever do an LUD anymore. We do capital surcharges. It's cleaner, they're easier. Been really successful at getting grants and low interest loans. Those kind of are incorporated in the new flow chart. And then the last one here is the distribution system fee for subdividing single parcel into two lots. Fortunately, when someone has an 10-acre lot and they want to divide it into 2 5-acre lots, maybe for their son or daughter, right now we treat that as any other development, which we charge a front footage fee for that cost rather than a per lot fee. That can get really expensive. So if you're just subdividing, it might be $20,000 just for that fee, which is didn't seem reasonable for these small subdivisions. So the two lot subdivisions, we just change that to make kind of a flat fee. Similar to if you just have a single family home and you want to connect our system, that is also just a flat fee. So again, we did about this with internal district water staff. Customer service had a lot of input in trying to make it consistent with the customer service electric system, customer service regs. Local developers, development engineering firms, and Master Builders Association. Some of the dates that we met with after the December 20th, got input from them, giving them opportunity to review and input the policy changes. They wanted more. And that's why this has been kind of tabled for since December. So bring that back. OGM, we had a lot of good conversations with them. Just last week, we had a meeting with master builders and some development and their engineers talking about our standards and maybe some things that could change. An example is that forever we've used copper for our service line material. Copper is getting really expensive. I think it's gone up, some last 3 years, I think it's gone up like 60% cost of copper. So about maybe changing that to a polyethylene or another type of material that wouldn't be as expensive both for us and for the development we need to install new services. Tonight, that's something that we actually floated, not the development community, but things like that. If there's ways that we could change our standards that still make sense, still protect our system, but be built more efficiently or cheaper, then that's a good thing. So we want to get that input from the builders and their engineers.
I would assume you're not going to sacrifice quality though in making these changes.
Well, even if we change to like polyethylene service line, we would have a tracer wire so we could locate the services. It is just getting expensive. A roll of copper right now is, I believe, around $700 for a roll of copper. That's almost half the cost of what we currently charge for the fee to install a service. So just the copper alone is very expensive and it gets stolen. We used to put in what we call tail pieces off the back of the meter, and we put in meters in the plats that people would come around and they would steal every single one of those. So it is a little bit like putting gold in the ground. And so things like that, just look at it. And again, we'll have those conversations. If it doesn't make sense, again, it's our responsibility to make sure that it's a long-term good standard.
And we're going to have a good percentage of other water utilities going to the newer material.
There's a lot of utilities that use polyethylene pipe, so the black pipe, PEX pipe, they're another option. So we're looking at the different options.
And so is the PD responsible for that part of the system in the future, or right up to the connection to the house? Or
no, the PD is only responsible from the main to the meter. For the most part. So this is a different conversation, but there's a revised lead and copper rule that is out that we have to address. We actually have to look at what the customer side service line material is made of. And if there's any lead, it's galvanized, you don't know what it is, we have to identify it. So that's a big push right now that we're going through. We have to actually identify every single service line on the customer side that we've never tracked because they're not our responsibility. Next year. It's a huge effort that's going on right now. So it's a revised lead and copper rule, but and there is some potential that if there is lead that they may require utilities actually replacing those private service lines
mm-hmm.
that come through yet. Luckily we're I mean for us, luckily most of our distribution system was built, you know, in the late 40s, 50s. So there isn't a high percentage chance that there are any lead. I've been here 31 years, talked to the foreman. Foremen, they've been here before me, before they retired. They've never seen any of their work in the system. They've never seen either a lead gooseneck or a service line. So that in itself doesn't count for EPA, but it does. It's good to know that we don't think we have it. I mean, if we've never seen one, but we still have to go through the process of proving it. And me saying it or foreman saying it doesn't qualify for good enough. So we actually do a little bit of our effort, and that's what we're processing right now. So sorry, that was a long.
No,
it was a long.
And I asked the question because I realized for electricity, the meter is typically on the side of the house. But for water, it's out in the street. So when you're talking about replacing that copper, I can see how that potentially could impact the customer because it's such a ductile material that handles settling so well.
And most service lines from the meter to the home are a polyethylene, PVC,
okay.
Other types of materials.
Thank you.
Section one, again, just general housekeeping, real policy changes in section one. Again, you will see our sheet of resolution, a complete marked up copy of all sections of all the red lines, even the housekeeping changes. I'm just going over the bigger ones in this presentation. This was the language that we talked about. Related to termination of a service. What we're trying to get at here is if there's a system like our warranty system that has a capital surcharge, if someone is going to snowbird and wants to go to California for the winter, if they're allowed to cut out a service and not pay that fee, capital surcharge, money that we collect to pay back that $6.4 million loan, we would be getting the revenue that we need to pay that back. So this just basically says you can't cut those. You can't cut out our service. You still have to pay those fees, even if you want to go on vacation for 6 months somewhere else. This is the actual language related to the GFC and the distribution system charge, and allowing us to just waive those fees in the case like City of Everett's transmission lines trying to promote those customers from disconnecting from that transmission line and connecting to distribution system if it's available and if it's there. This allows that to happen. It's a little bit hard to convince someone to disconnect and connect to our distribution system when they're end up getting basically the same water. It's not as reliable because it doesn't have the storage behind it. It's a transmission line. It's not made for distribution. It's made for transmission of that main or that water. However, it's still hard to get a customer pay all the fees. Disconnect.
Yeah.
We've tried to make it where we will waive these fees. The city that wants it to happen, they'll pay the physical cost of putting in the new meter, and the customer would pay the cost of connecting that or changing their service line, their private service line. In a lot of cases, transmission line might be behind their homes, so they have to actually put in service line. So that's an expense too. So it's kind of a three partners trying to make this transition happen. Us waiving our fees, cities actually paying for the actual physical meter install, and then the customers having to deal with their own service lines.
Is it just a bad practice to have to be connected small connections to transmission lines?
Yeah, because so from the city's perspective, that is a transmission line, so they're not guaranteeing that line is always going to be moving water.
Right.
It's not always going to be, and so when they take it down, they have no backup storage to keep the customers in water. So it might be they have a major break. It might be a long time where those customers will be out of water. Cities want it off. For us, it is our retail service area. It's within a retail service area. We want to provide service to those customers. We want to clean. Instead of going down the street and saying, well, this person has water, not a PUD customer. Where are they getting their water from? Do they have a well? How long do they have? They're connected off the transmission. So it just kind of clears up some of those confusion.
What are you saying that? Customers are hesitant because of cost.
So if
their water rates be higher?
Their water rates would be about the same, but the cost to actually hook up is a lot more. And some of those are really, there might be one person that has a connection to the city of Everett. You have five people that they're stringing out, serving off of that. So for all customers, it makes it confusing. Who are they actually getting their water from? But without us trying to waive these, we've got $10,000 of fees, or roughly, that they would have to pay on top of the service line, on top of the actual new service that they have to put in off our distribution main. So it is expensive. Again, they still have water, so it's like, okay, I have water, I'm not gonna. And we've never forced them, and the cities have never forced them. They encouraged it. This just tries to encourage and clean it up. This is actually one of the recommendations that came from the development community. We didn't used to for oversizing for smaller pipes. We didn't used to include labor costs, we just included material costs, just kind of clean, easy. Is fine addition. So they just wanted to include it when we're asking them to oversize to do reasonable labor costs. The reason we didn't in the past is the labor put in a 4-inch pipe versus an 8-inch pipe is pretty much the same. I don't think it's going to really change anything as far as from our perspective. It's something that the development community wanted. I think it makes sense.
And so some developers want the bigger size because they're expecting to expand their development, something like that.
Well, so this is oversizing. So if we have a need for additional capacity transmission, we've identified that need, then we can work with the developers. They would have to put in, let's say, if their minimum main size that they would have to put in would be 8-inch, and we want it 12-inch. We actually pay them to oversize that main that runs through their project. So most developers don't want to put anything larger than what they have to do for the one specific project. But
I see. So we would be the ones seeking the largest, not
we would be the ones looking to see is there an opportunity for us to oversize the main to provide additional capacity to these other areas.
Okay, that's
And this is just while it's being built, it's the cheapest way for us to put in, for us to oversize
right.
that.
Yeah. So reasonable labor cost means we're eating some of the costs.
So what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to get a couple bids of, let's say we want them to go to 12-inch and they were going to put in 8-inch, they'd have to get a couple bids saying that additional labor associated with putting in a 12-inch main, a couple more bolts on all the fittings, a little bit bigger pipe is X, and again, it's it's not as cut and dried as it was before, because before it was just kind of black and white, but it's a reasonable one to ask. And then again, on the satellite management, system management, we just updated the flow chart to more clearly show how we take on new water systems now. So we're in different. This is the talk about as far as the change for a single family or for a two-party subdivision. So lot one and two might have been someone that owned a 10-acre parcel. This just gives you an example. Or you're doing a two-party subdivision, two-lot subdivision, you would look at the front footage of both, multiply it by the front footage of $38 a foot, and it'd be $22,000 for that. What we're proposing is that that would just be based on the, similar to a single family home, two lots, $4,200 piece, $84.20 for that same, which makes sense. Again, these aren't big developers. This is typically someone that wants to subdivide an existing 10 acre lot, split off one to serve so their kids can have the other lot. They're not, it's not a 30 lot plat. It's not, they're not professional developers. And that just kind of deals with the $22,000. And it's just, it's a lot of money, something like that. This is just an example, but it's a common example that this change will fix. Overall, it doesn't happen that much. It's not like it's gonna be a huge revenue.
Has this always been that way?
It's always been that way.
For some reason, a long time ago, there was discussion about doing adjustments.
I mean, it is one of those things that it's hard when someone's really upset about it, you know, that it's costing me $22,000, just the DSC portion. So you add the other fees on, it might be $30,000 to get water for two lots. I just want to get off my well, or I just want to, you know, split my lot so my kid can have it, and beauty water is so expensive. And again, this isn't just beauty water. I mean, a lot of utilities do the same thing when they have these connection charges.
It's the price of my $40 comes here for our vision. Sure, that cost for this.
So this will be a way that that hopefully you know.
Okay.
Again, next steps, if you have any feedback, let me hear any feedback, we'll incorporate that. We'll clean up and have a final line draft for you to look at with the resolution and for you to approve on this 22nd meeting.
Appreciated all your charts, the flow charts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Brent. Excellent job. And last up on the agenda is Hat Island Cable Procurement Special Facility Designation.
Sure, great.
Oh, sure.
Sure, Wolf.
I'm sorry, what was that?
We need a short break, Commissioner Wolf.
Oh, it's 10:07. I'm up until what, 10:15?
It's a few.
I mean, you know, I can't read between. Okay, 10:15. All right, let's be back on time or early. 10:15.
Good morning, Mark.
Yes.
Good
morning, John. Morning, everyone. Good morning, Commissioners. Appreciate your time this morning. I'm Mark Fleury. I'm the Senior Manager over in D&E, and I'm here to speak to you about the Hat Island Cable Procurement, specifically about special facility status and a resolution I'd like to preview with you today that we'd like to bring forward on the 22nd. But also, this is a great opportunity just to update you in general on the project and the procurement approach for the project. So that first bullet there touches on the resolution. So we're going to bring for consideration at the next session a resolution that just attaches to a piece of the project, and that's the cable procurement. We'd like to designate that special facilities under exemption to competitive bidding requirements in Chapter 39004 RCW. But then again, this is an opportunity to update you on the entire project. So I'll also speak to procurement of the power cable and associated equipment, maybe a general overview of the contracting, and then some summary of next actions finally to close out here. And I know several of you commissioners have questions, so please stop me at the appropriate slide. I know there's one that's diagrammatic that shows the alignment, and then ask your questions during the course of the presentation if you would, please. So the exemptions to competitive bidding requirements, state law provides uniform exemptions to competitive bidding requirements utilized by municipalities when awarding contracts for public work and contracts for purchases. And that's found in 3904-280. These competitive bidding requirements may be waived by the commission for purchases involving special facilities or market conditions, and I'll definitely speak to that today. That's found in 3904-281-B. The tool is to waive those competitive bidding requirements is by resolution. We'll be bringing that in 2 weeks for your consideration. So why is staff making this request? That's because of the complex makeup of the submarine power cable, together with current market conditions and variable and proprietary manufacturing methodologies, make the selection a very important piece that can't be based on price alone. However, I want to ensure you that price will be a big component of the solution that we select. We'll utilize transparent evaluation criteria rather than price alone, and that'll allow district engineers, along with our consultant, to consider the strength of each proposal that will result in the best overall value to the district. What I'd like to point out to the commission here is that we have used this tool in the past. We used it on Hancock and Callaghan for the turbine generator procurements. We looked not only at price, but we looked at how the specific proposal might impact the powerhouse, which had already been designed. We looked at runaway speeds, which informed how fast we would need to get to the site in case we had a turbine in runaway mode. And we also looked at the ability to meet our delivery schedule, which I suspect be one of the evaluation criteria we'd want to use here. So if we had a more expensive cable that might come a year delayed versus a more inexpensive cable that would be on time, I said that. If we had a more expensive cable, we could get sooner, and a less expensive cable the following year. That'd be a great conversation to have internally to make a decision around that.
So can you go back just for a second?
Absolutely.
Okay, so these evaluation criteria include quite a number of things, and you can't really be specific right now because there's so many factors.
We do have those evaluation criteria established. We'd be happy to share them, but I don't want to preview what we're going to be evaluating these proposals by in advance of publishing the RFP. If that makes sense.
Okay, it makes sense here. Okay. So my follow-up thought was, how are you going to decide about the strength of each proposal?
So we'll have a weighting factor applied to each of the criteria. So we might weight price at the top and ability to deliver at the bottom, or other way around, but we'll have those criteria transparently provided in the RFPs when we publish, so the vendors will know where they stand. And then when we go through the evaluation, they'll have known that in advance as well.
And will the board we would be privy to those?
Absolutely. We'll bring a presentation with the recommendation for award of the material purchase, and we'll present on the criteria and how we evaluate. That's what we've done traditionally in the past with this type of special facility.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So a little background by way of reminder. It's been a little bit of time since we've been to the commission to update them on this project, but the existing cable was installed in 1974 from the landing on the Hat Island Beach over to Mission Beach. We had a failure of one phase, which occurred in 2018, and that was after 44 years of operation. Fortunately, as you all know, we were able to discover the fault location and repair it in 2022. So now we have an intact, albeit spliced, cable serving the island. That doesn't change the fact that the cable is at or near the end of its useful life. So we've continued undeterred to try to install the new cable and moving forward with this RFP.
So have we always owned the cable?
So we've switched from trying to parallel that previous alignment that I showed you to Mission Beach to a new alignment, which lands at the south terminal of Port Everett. And this is your crude drawing of what that alignment looks like. But our goal is to install this cable in Q3, Q4 of next year, 2024. The original landing site is not available. That's why we've had to switch alignments. We've been working with the Port of Everett quite diligently on this new landing site. You've got the framework of an agreement that's being reviewed by their legal department right now, and I'm quite optimistic we'll have that wrapped up in the next couple of weeks.
And are we able to know why it was not available, or is that private?
We just couldn't reach agreement with the underlying landowner for new easements. We needed a new location to bring the cable on the land. We tried and worked with them for several months and very diligent about it, but we're unsuccessful. So we've had to shift gears. We've lost a little bit of time. We've lost some engineering hours studying that original alignment. But again, all signs point to this being a very, very favorable approach. And we're very near agreement with the Port of Everett at this point.
How much longer is it than the original?
It's nearly twice the length. It's 7 miles, twice the length.
Twice as long.
Twice as long, yeah.
So does that mean twice the cost?
Twice the cable cost, yeah.
That's what I meant, yeah. And we're going to have to hire a contractor to do the work.
Absolutely, and I'm going to get into that in a couple of slides here and share the approach on that.
So Mark, I had a question about this slide. I couldn't tell by the path, but I wanted to make sure that it's going to miss that shoal area. You can see the chart in the previous slide.
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner Logan. We've got real concerns about this alignment because it's moving through a fairly active area.
It is.
The south terminal there, the port has expansion plans to do some dredging work there, so we have to ensure we accommodate that. There's an anchorage area here in this location that we're avoiding. And then the shoal you're alluding to is here off the south end of the island, and we'll be avoiding that as well. You'll see on a follow-on slide, to protect the near shore environment and to protect the cable near the shore, we've had erosion issues on Hat Island. We'll be directional drilling a conduit and then feeding the cable through that conduit. And so the cable is first exposed on the subsea floor at a depth of about 40 to 50 feet. Then it very quickly dives down to a depth of 300 to 400 feet, which should avoid any anchorage issues.
Yeah. You know, the challenges, or a challenge is cable areas are marked on charts, but the U.S. government is getting away from paper charts completely. With electronic charting, you don't always see that. Depending on how zoomed in or zoomed out you are, the scale you're at.
Yeah.
And people aren't, and why they don't look at charts often anyway. So,
yeah.
The water depth, if you stay in the deeper water, hopefully.
Yeah, 300 to 400 feet.
Shipping anchorage area.
It is, yeah. So, that area I pointed out where you do often see some barges anchored is 30 to 40 feet in depth, and it very quickly dives off to about 300 to 400 feet through here through that area.
So I have a question about the service. Oh, I'm sorry, did you finish?
No, yeah.
Don't want to interrupt you. Hat Island, how many occupants are?
Approximately 50 full-time and about 250 seasonal.
About 50 full-time and about 250
seasonal.
To mention?
Yeah, they generally come with Memorial Day and depart with Labor Day.
Okay. And are we obligated to provide power year round?
Yeah, they'll have a tariff essentially, won't they?
That's right.
Versus for the cost of this over some life of it.
Yeah, it's been a few years since we presented on this, but there'll be a tariff where we're going to be financing the cable and the installation over a term of 50 years. We'll be paying back that cost with an additional daily surcharge on there. Or other fees.
Some people are already paying some surcharge. They have been for a number of years.
They have been, and it was terminated for a number of years.
Okay. Okay.
And then couple that with the fact that what they've been paying doesn't nearly cover the cost of the project. Yeah.
So, do the people who live there, or people who pay the bills, pay the tariff, do they have an option to opt out of having service if they want to provide their own solar or whatever?
I don't know the answer to that. John or Colin, do you know the answer to that?
Technically, you could not take service.
As a whole island? I mean, if is the island organized to, like, do they have community decision-making process, do you know?
They have a great leadership over there. It's their homeowners association. Yeah, they meet regularly, and that's primarily the body that we communicate with. But we've been communicating regularly with them, as I mentioned, and they're aware of the surcharge. And now, of course, we're going to have to true that up with actual costs. But we've been able to keep them updated with kind of an order of magnitude of what that surcharge will be. And they have not, in any of the regular updates, made any kind of motion that they'd like to terminate service. I think they're pretty happy that the cable's been repaired.
It occurred to me.
Yeah.
I've lived on islands, and I know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'll move on to the next slide here. This is a profile that shows those near shore directional drills that I was mentioning. So you can see we're quite at a depth below the existing surface. And then as you move out past the water line, that HDD exit point is annotating the horizontal directional drill exit point. So that's the point at which the cable would actually lie on this subsurface floor, T-floor. Each landing will have a conduit like this, and it will be directionally drilled. And as I mentioned, in response to your question, Commissioner Wolf, the cable length is now 7 miles, which is about twice what we previously anticipated. And the cable depth is generally in excess of 300 or 400 feet, as noted there.
Are there any other facilities in this track here, like other cables?
There is. That's a great question, Commissioner Olson. Okay. The reason we picked this landing in part is because there's an existing cable that launches from this Pigeon Creek area and heads due west over to Whidbey Island, bringing fiber optic over to the island. So we're aware of the cable. We've got plans on where the cable lies. We'll be just to the northeast of it, and then we'll head over to Hat Island. So we'll be sure to avoid it.
With the right distances and that.
Yeah, cable crossings, as you know, from the tidal project or something to avoid.
That's why I'm asking these questions.
So yeah, that's definitely on our mind, and we're sure that we're engineering this to avoid any kind of cable crossing.
That's smart to protect the cable like this. I mean, that's essentially you're protecting the area where we had to do the splice.
Yeah, and if you think about over the years, how many times we had to go out there onto the beach and do emergency repairs to lower the cable and backfill it with sand, trying to protect it just wasn't effective. So this will solve that problem, I hope. So moving on with the cable procurement, the cable will be very similar to what we currently have in terms of aesthetics. Look the same when you cut through a cross section of it. We'll have three phases of neutral and fiber optics in the interstitial spaces that you can see there. It'll be 4 to 5 inches in diameter, similar to what we currently have serving the island. It's very important to staff that we get a continuous cable that doesn't have any splices in it. That's why one of the reasons that we're really keen on the special facilities to make sure that we can ensure the best solution, not necessarily the most cost-effective solution, meets our criteria.
Excuse me, 7 miles with no joints. Also, what's the longevity or anticipated long
life? This will be 50 to 70 years, especially in the cold, deeper water where we intend to lay it. That's going to help lengthen its life. It won't be exposed to as much heat generated from that.
Will these customers use our new connect up meters?
They will. So I think they're going to be one of the first deployment areas.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
John?
Okay.
But they think we made it compulsory. They got to carve out that they can't opt out.
That makes sense.
We're going to have to roll out to read the meter.
Specifications for the components that make up the cable can vary greatly between manufacturers. So we'll look at those specifications, we'll look at those against our standards, and then we'll make a decision on the best solution. One of the biggest drivers for our concerns is this first bullet point here. Many of the largest cable manufacturers have indicated through conversations with us that they just don't have that much interest in the project. A single 7 mile lay is not that important to these manufacturers, just with what's going on with the wind right now. Yeah. So due to increasing demand from offshore wind developers, we haven't seen a lot of interest, and it spooked us a little bit. And I think that's large part why we'd like to have some flexibility around the solution selection. There's no clear end in sight to this offshore wind demand. And many of the remaining manufacturers who have expressed interest don't have any experience or really any at all in the United States or North America. So we want to be really cautious and measured with our approach, but cast a wide net at the same time.
Have you consulted with Opalco?
Yeah.
Because they have a lot of cable.
Yeah, BC Hydro as well. Yeah, they have a lot of submarine cable. They've been great allies in this.
Yeah, that's a good point. It just seems like there's a lot of knowledge regionally about laying cable. And I imagine there's a handful of contractors the kinds of cable.
There it is. Yeah, so I think Opalco has 29 or 30 submarine cables. Yeah. So they've been great to work with. 29 or 30 submarine cables, Opalco.
Southtown, there must be some tools.
So now I'm shifting gears from talking specifically about the approach on the cable purchase and talking about the overall approach to the project. So item number one there, the cable procurement, I spoke to that. We're intending to bring forward for your consideration a resolution to allow for special facility status on that. There is also the public works contract for the site development, and that's shown by that blue circle there. That's primarily setting up to do the directional drilling and doing the onshore site work to enable for the cable to make connection to our system. That'll in all likelihood be a local contractor that has directional drilling capabilities. We'll mark the end of the submerged conduit and have a diver go down, feed the cable into the conduit and bring it back to the surface. So that's a second component that
we'll remove. Well, yeah, being local is not a criteria when you select the bidder.
No, it's not one of the criteria. It's just, it was more of a fact, Commissioner Olson, that I was stating in all likelihood, the most competitive bid we're going to get is somebody who doesn't have to mobilize across the
great distance. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
But by no means will we be dictating that. That's just going to be the reality of the contracting world. And lastly, the cable installation, which will be a specialty contractor, again, most likely from this area, somewhere along the West Coast, because they'll be bringing in a large barge and a carousel, and they'll be setting up to lay the cable. The operation itself is just a few days, as you can imagine. It doesn't take that long to traverse a 7-mile distance. That's a third contract that we'll have to bring forward to you, and I'll talk a little bit about the schedule for that. But that's that in the lower right corner, that PWC cable installation. And there really is an important reciprocal relationship that occurs between the manufacturer who provides the cable and that cable installation contractor, because they have to accept the cable. There has to be a transfer of a very large cable from their facility to our contractor's facility. And then we have to ensure that there's specification on how it's handled. So in the case that there's any damage to the cable, know who to speak to about the damage. So that's going to be an important part of the project that we have to ensure that we have covered well in the specifications. So the cable procurement, the entity that manufactures the submarine cable and delivers it to the Puget Sound, this is kind of a visual for that portion of the contract, which was the first bulleted item on the previous slide. So you can see, you know, this is an extremely large carousel or an extremely long cable. Site work contractor, shown here, the directional drill again, I've shown this exhibit before. They're primarily there to prepare each end on the ground, do the site work, directional drill, and then provide faults and transformer installation and distribution tie-ins to our system. And then lastly, the vendor that provides the cable installation, and you can see the specialty type of barge that's used for that work in that photo there. And not only would they lay the cable, they would bring the cable up through the conduit, and then they would be responsible for testing and connections at either end. So in terms of next steps, we'd like to bring for your consideration a resolution in the next board packet for the next board meeting. And that would be to declare a portion of the submarine cable project, namely the cable procurement, as a special facilities under RCW 3904-280. There's a couple of future board actions that I alluded to today during the presentation that are summarized here. So that cable procurement contract, in October 2023, we anticipate bringing that to you. Public Works contract award for the cable installation, that's that handoff and that reciprocal vendor, that would be in Q4 of 2023, so the end of this year. And a site development PWC for that site development work, that third component in the first quarter of next year. I would point out, because I spoke to this earlier, that some of the engineering effort that we spent on the initial alignment and studies that we performed were lost for all intents and purposes because we switched alignment. Not all of that was transferable, so we are going to be bringing an amendment for our engineering consultants contract to add additional dollars.
That's a question I have about the studies.
Well, right now, the people on Cat Island do have electricity.
They do. They have three-phase power.
So will that be removed, or what
will
happen to the
old? Well, we have not really fully formulated a plan for that. We could get asked by governing entity such as the Department of Ecology to remove the cable. We'd like to talk about the impacts of removing that cable. There could be some environmental impacts associated with that. We'd like to leave the cable in place. There's a lot of stakeholders that we need to negotiate and discuss that with. At this point in time, our energy has been really focused on getting this project across the finish line.
Great. I mean, one last item I want to make sure I am clear on. Except for the cable, the other work will be competitively bid.
That's correct.
Is it?
So, Mark, is this cable unique? I mean, it seemed like it's going to be a smaller cable than most. I mean, it's not serving a lot of customers compared to
Island
and the San Juans, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I think, I want to make sure I understand your question. Is it unique, and what is unique about it that's causing our concerns about the procurement?
No. Is it unique in that there's not a lot of organizations that make small undersea cable?
No, they do.
Small relative to other undersea cables, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, it's not small relative to what you'd see up for Opalco and BC Hydro. I think one of the main things that we're competing against is the fact that all manufacturers in North America that we would want to go to for procurement of this cable have back orders for wind.
Gotcha.
And to slip in such a small cable into their production sequence is not something that we'd consider. If we were a repeat customer or we had 40, 50 wind farms down the road that we had planned, we probably would get their attention, but we're just not seeing it.
It's the last question. If we go through this process and the cable is just unwildly expensive, are you going to go back to that community and say, well, this is the tariff we thought you'd have. Now this is the tariff's going to be larger. Is there a feedback loop?
Yes.
For a decision to go?
In fact, I just spoke to Guy about this particular issue this week, and that we do have a good estimate in the capital plan for this project. It's been updated to reflect the new cable length. And again, that's the entire project budget hasn't been doubled, but that portion that can be attributed to the cable has doubled. And we owe the Hat Island community an update here in the near future once we have some better ideas on costs. And then finally, the surcharge will be based on actual construction costs, not just estimates. The estimates are a great tool to allow them and us to plan, but they'll be based on actual.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Thank
you.
Oh, excuse me. What is the involvement of the Corps? How are they involved financially or in any other way?
They've been heavily involved. That's a great question. There's a lot going on there. So we're in an area of the South Terminal that they've designated as just a disposal area. So there's not a huge impact, but of course they need to grant us easements, both temporary and permanent easements for the cable landing. So that's been their involvement. They don't have a financial involvement that I'm aware of, but they do have future cleanup plans in that area, which has been a real challenge to navigate. So as a part of the agreement, we've had to agree to be able to move and make accommodations in that area where we're going to have our facilities to accommodate their cleanup. And that's been a real challenge to navigate. But our lead point person on this, Eric Schneider, has done a phenomenal job working with them and negotiating an agreement, addressing their concerns.
So the cleanup operation is the principal concern involvement that will happen?
It was the principal complication in the agreement for certain.
Okay. And so the Port of Everett has already discussed this. They've approved are doing this.
We've got a draft agreement that addresses all the salient points that has been negotiated at the staff level that is in right now with their legal department for review.
Okay. So I'm hearing that the recipients of this benefit are responsible for the cost, and we're not asking our general ratepayers who receive no benefit from it in any way to subsidize this.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, those costs to install the new cable, all the materials, the equipment are factored into the tariff and will be reconciled once we have actual costs.
Thank you.
All right, well, any additional questions? Great questions, Dave. It's a complex project, and that's really why it's taken us the amount of time it's taken to get to this point.
It's quite a project. Good luck.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for your questions and your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good job. Good. Okay, that wraps up our presentations. Just as an FYI, let the board know I will not be here this afternoon. I am joining Seattle City Light and PSC to meet with the State Department's chief negotiator for the Columbia River Treaty this afternoon. So Guy Payne will be filling in for me this afternoon.
Thank you, John. Hope that goes well. It's an interesting topic. It is now 10:42 p.m. and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.